Everybody is ready. It's 8 o'clock. Excellent. So last week I had the privilege of being in Eretz Yisrael for the 75th anniversary of Yom HaAtzmaut. They had the World Mizrahi Conference. And while I was there, I noticed that there were demonstrations practically every single day, including Thursday night when I returned to the hotel where I was staying. I stayed at the Jerusalem Gate, very nice hotel, which is right next to the Takana HaMerkazit. I had to practically claw my way past the throngs of people who were demonstrating at the Takana HaMerkazit. I had to ask like which side they were on, because you couldn't necessarily tell. In terms of, there was so much of a din and so much noise, sound and fury, presumably signifying something, but I couldn't really tell. It turns out that the demonstrations that were taking place at least Thursday night were in support of the judicial reform proposals, which has stirred up a lot of emotion, a lot of controversy. It's not the official subject for tonight's shiur. But there were, I think, about 150,000 demonstrators who were all demonstrating in favor of judicial reform, and that was to counteract all of the demonstrators, whom I think were even greater in number, who had been demonstrating the previous 7 weeks or so in opposition to judicial reform. But if you asked your average person what in the world was on the table in terms of judicial reform, nobody would have any clue for the most part. I did try to read up on exactly what the judicial reform proposals are. What I found very interesting is that some people who are very near and dear to myself have very passionate views about that particular issue in both directions. So I had some family members who live in Eretz Yisrael, who are more in the Haredi camp, send me various videos of Nachum Rackover, who's a professor of Jewish law, Mishpat Ivri, somebody whom I very much respect, explaining why judicial reform is a very, very wonderful thing, and it's so important that Israel conducts this judicial reform, because otherwise they have basically a tyranny by the judiciary against the majority of the country. And then I have some lawyer friends, including the head of the Federation in New York, whom I haven't spoken to about this, but whom I know feels very, very strongly about this, Eric Goldstein, who used to be the president of the Beit Din of America, who made some sort of a statement that he was extremely concerned about the judicial reform legislation going on in Israel. Not that any American support or Federation support should be dependent upon it, but that he was very worried about it from the standpoint of the future of the democracy of Israel. And at least one other attorney from Skokie, who didn't authorize the use of his name, not that anybody else did either, but whom I won't mention, who also told me that he has grave concerns about this, and I have to take that seriously, because he's also somebody I very much respect. So I know better than to stake out a position regarding this matter. But when I spent Shabbos at my brother-in-law and sister-in-law in Beit Shemesh, my brother-in-law is on the city council. He's a member of the Likud, I think. So he's on the city council of Beit Shemesh. And I asked him just to give a dispassionate, objective explanation of the two different viewpoints so I can understand them better. And he sent me various articles and videos, and I appreciated that very much. So I think I do have a better understanding of that issue. But there's nothing to do with halacha per se. I think if I have some time, I'm always very optimistic when it comes to that the question. I will maybe speak a little bit about kind of a totally different take on the judicial reform proposal. But what is interesting is that the demonstrations, pro and con, for and against, taking place in Israel, do not seem to be directed towards this other issue, which is also looming very large in Israel right now, which is an effort to potentially modify the law of return. The law of return, we know, is very central to Jewish identity. It has to do with the whole question of Mihu Yehudi, who is considered to be a Jew, and it's based on this legislation that was passed in really the early years of the Medina, that Israel should be a refuge, should be a homeland for every single Jew in the world, that there shouldn't be any question of being granted citizenship if you're a Jew. Just like every single Jew has Dalet Amos of Karka in Eretz Yisrael, right? That there is that sort of halachic notion. So there's a notion that every single Jew, of course, belongs in Eretz Yisrael. This land is our land. is the land that was promised to Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and that we should be able to enter into the land automatically without having to go through the whole rigmarole of a long citizenship process. And over the decades, there have been certain adjustments, fine-tuning with respect to the law of return, because I was listening to a very nice lecture given by Rabbi Jonathan Muscat recently about this issue, where he said this is a great example of the perfect being the enemy of the good. I think was the way that he put it, that this is a very good thing, obviously, especially in the aftermath of the Holocaust. You think about all the thousands of years of oppression, 2,000 years of galus, of the Jewish people, that every single Jew should feel that they're welcome in their homeland. But to make it perfect is very, very difficult, because there are the questions on the margins. What if a person converted out? What if a person converted in? What's the standard by which we determine that a person should be viewed as Jewish? What if you have a mixed, a blended family, where a person intermarried, and what person wants to return to Israel, but they want to return to Israel with their children and their grandchildren? So all of these, or what if a person is Jewish, but they represent a severe threat to the security of the state? So all of these questions have been dealt with in the legislation of the law of return. I thought it was something that for us to talk about now, and also the most current proposal to make certain changes to the law of return, really from the standpoint of, at least in terms of where some of the proponents are coming from the standpoint of halacha, and how much should there be an intersection between halacha and when we talk about something as fundamental as mihu Yehudi, the definition of a Jew, we would think is really very much a halachic definition. So we have to start out by pointing out that sometimes there is a difference, shockingly enough, between politics and halacha. And we've spoken in the past about how we as a Beis Din, for example, make a determination of who is Jewish. We spoke about the machlokas between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam that plays out in the Shulchan Aruch as well. Do we just trust any single person who comes into the Beis Din and says, "Hi, you don't know me, but I'm Jewish"? Do we say that there's a chazaka, that every single person who says they're Jewish is presumably Jewish? That certainly was the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam. And that would be the strict halacha, according to many, many authorities, that we would follow nowadays, except that we're worried that the lines have gotten blurred over the years, and we don't have the same chazakos that a person necessarily can be trusted, or that people necessarily even know how to define Jewishness nowadays. So Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Zatzal, is, of course, we've been speaking about a lot lately as we've gone through all of his tshuvos. Rav Schwartz was fond of quoting the Beit Hillel. It was a 17th century rabbinic personality. He was a dayan on the Beis Din of the Chelkos Mechokek. And the Beit Hillel, who was a leading authority in Lithuania, spoke about a takanas lita, a takana in Lithuania, that nowadays, if we don't know the family and they're not already established as being Jews for generations, and somebody just walks in and says, "Hi, I'm Jewish," they have to prove their mettle. They have to bring, you know, proof and evidence that they really are Jewish in order for us to admit anybody as Jewish. He says that's basically the policy that is followed by our Bati Din and Bati Din all over the world, that we require a person to bring evidence, testimony from individuals who know them, parents, ksuva, grave markers, matzevos, evidence, testimony from rabbanim of communities, etc., in order to really make a determination that a person satisfies the test of being considered to be Jewish halakhically. And then we spoke about different populations where there were questions that arose with respect to the Ethiopians. Did they really have a good chazaka being Jewish? Maybe it depends on where in Ethiopia they came from, whether they came from established families that were known to be Jewish. What about all of the different tribes from India, the B'nai Israel? Are they considered to be Jewish? And you have different opinions amongst the poskim who say that with some of these populations, there is a chazaka that was established throughout the generations that they're really Jewish. Rav Avadya Yosef very much pushed the Ethiopians based on a tshuva of the Radbais, who said that the Ethiopians, the Falashas, were Jewish, and he felt that you could rely upon that. And there was a little bit of a caveat that was added to the discussion later on by his son that, well, maybe that depends on just how much of the Ethiopian rabbinic authorities, such as they are, can really attest to that being the case, because there's some Ethiopians who clearly don't have the same chazaka being Jewish. the latest group that was left behind over the past number of years. And then you had the general psak by most poskim, who said that the Bnei Israel from India didn't really have the same chazakah of being Jewish, and therefore really should undergo a conversion. But the Rabbanut HaRashit officially did accept the Bnei Israel as Jewish, and that also creates what I would say within the halakhic universe a little bit of tension as to which groups we consider to have a strong cheskas Yadus and which ones we don't consider to have a strong cheskas Yadus. But that's kind of just the halakhic discussion. And then you have the political discussion of do we turn to the halakhic authorities to make these types of determinations, or are they made by the Misrad HaPnim? Are they made by the Interior Ministry of Israel as opposed to rabbinic authorities? And who is the ultimate authority with respect to determining which conversions are considered to be acceptable? Do we accept patrilineal descent? And what ended up happening over the years, as we'll see, is that it's become sort of like a hodgepodge. To a certain degree, the law of return is premised upon age-old halakhic principles, and to a certain degree, it's not based upon halakhic principles one iota. And there are certain elements of the law of return that clearly say that a person can be non-Jewish according to every opinion, and we're still going to grant them automatic citizenship under the law of return. So it's become a little bit of a morass. I want to give a little bit of the history. I want to give a little bit of a halakhic perspective. So the law of return was passed in 1950 by the Knesset. It was passed unanimously. The date that it was passed was Chof Tammuz Tavshin Yud. That's July 5th, okay, 1950. And the main line, if you take a look at the very first sentence, this is in source 5, actually, which says, every Jew has the right to come to this country as an Oleh. An Oleh, of course, means as a citizen, as somebody who is coming from the outside and being granted citizenship. We still have that term Oleh. Someone rises up, Ara Yom Mazeh, every Jew. So it was felt that's the sentiment, that's the philosophical idea, that's our metaphysical idea, if you will, that every single Jew has the right to the state of Israel. And there are biblical overtones to all of this. Even if you look at the Declaration of Independence of the State of Israel, which is Source 3, which had stated, this is 2 years earlier, this is Heir. We know that Heir is, of course, identical to Yom Ha'atzma'ut, when it falls down on a Wednesday. But the very first time that Heir occurred, there was sort of the idea that it would always be Yom Ha'atzma'ut, because that is the day in which the Declaration of Independence was signed. That's the day that Israel was officially admitted as a nation by the United Nations, May 14, 1948, and it states, the Declaration of Independence, the State of Israel will be open for Jewish immigration and for the ingathering of the exiles. These are biblical-type expressions. Even if the people who were the leaders of the State of Israel in its incipient stages, like David Ben-Gurion and the like, were very secular and socialist in their orientation, but they were also very biblical and very Jewish in their orientation as well. They weren't Ami Haaretz. Certainly when it came to Torah Shebichtav, they had a sense of being the people, the descendants of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. You take a look at sources of Aleph and Beis. So we have this idea of the Jewish of the Jewish land being the State of Israel from time immemorial, that Avraham was promised by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, V'yarashem al Avraham, V'yem lezaracha, tenas ha'aretz hazos, I'm going to give your descendants this land. And this was something that was never taken away. Even when we went into exile, the land never lost the ownership, so to speak, of the Jewish people. It was always something designated for us. You take a look at what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Yaakov Avinu in Parshas Vayetze, V'nei Hashem mitzav olav v'yomar, Ani Hashem elokei Avraham avicha v'elokei Yitzchak, Ha'aretz asher atah shochev aleha, l'cha etnenu lezarecha, this is your land that I gave, I promised to Avraham, to Yitzchak, and to you as well. For Rachtar Yom of Akedma Mitzafon of Enegba, we know we like to sing that song, right? It extends in all directions. This is very firmly set in stone, so to speak, that we all are familiar with the very first Rashi to the Torah. Rashi says, why isn't the Torah begin with the Chodesh Zelachem? In order to establish very firmly that the land of Israel belongs to us, just like a Kodesh Baruch Hu moved other people around in order to give different nations different lands. So it tells this, the Torah tells the story of how Eretz Yisrael was the land that a Kodesh Baruch Hu gave to us. And we know you take a look at the Rambam in Source Dalet over here, that there are certain halachic acts of that, for example, can only be performed in Eretz Yisrael. Rambam even says at one point in time that we wouldn't be able to sanctify the new months of every single year, which establishes when our holidays take place, if you didn't have a constant residence of some sampling of the Jews living in Israel. Even during the exile, there had to, according to the Rambam, there had to always be some Jews living in Israel, because this is the essence of the Jewish people, whomever happens to be in Israel. So, for example, we don't give official smicha. Nowadays, our smicha is not the old-time smicha, it's an imitation smicha. Don't tell anybody. I mean, you can, but it's not the original smicha. The original smicha can only be granted in Eretz Yisrael. As the Rambam says, Chos Sanhedrin, Perek Dalet, Halacha Vav, Ein Somkin Sakenim, Chutz La'aretz, and Vapilu Ayu Asomkin Ba'aretz or Nisma Chutz La'aretz, Ein Somkin, both that the one who confers smicha and the one who receives smicha, they both have to be in Eretz Yisrael, this is a part of the law of the land. And similarly, there are certain kabanos like Par Helim Dava Shel Tzibor. If the majority of the people sin and make a mistake, so we only count the majority of the people in terms of those who are living in Israel. Egla Rufa is only performed in Israel. A number of laws really that we say relate to the community of Israel, to our communal life, only are applicable in Eretz Yisrael. But listen to David Ben-Gurion himself in the speech that he gave to the Knesset in 1950, around the time in which this legislation was passed. It sounds really that it's based very much on this sensitivity and appreciation of Jewish tradition. This law does not provide for the state to bestow the right to settle upon the Jew living abroad. That's not what the law is about, he explains. He explains like this. It affirms that it's nothing new. It's not bestowing a new right. It's affirming a right that already exists from time immemorial. It affirms that this right is inherent in him. It is part of the chepza, of every single Jew, of who we are, from the very fact of being a Jew. The state does not grant the right of return to the Jews of the diaspora. It's not a right of return. It means that we are citizens of Israel, regardless of where we happen to be. When Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld was asked whether it was permissible for somebody from outside of Israel for some benefit to make the declaration that he was born in Israel, so he said, yes, of course, because we all are considered to be born in Israel, including the Pasuk in Tehillim, that this is part of whom we are. This right precedes the state. This right built the state. A source is to be found in the historic and never broken connection between the Jewish people and the homeland. So there was this biblical sense that this land was something that is not a new thing, Medina Yisrael, but it's Eretz Yisrael that is a part and parcel of the neshama and of the essence of every single Jew. But still, when the law of return was passed, there was some practical exclusions to the law, a certain amount of caution in terms of just making this a carte blanche license for any Jew to automatically be granted citizenship. Let's say that somebody was a real threat to the state. Let's say that there was somebody who was involved with plotting against the state, with treason against the state. So then certain exceptions were made. So that's what it said in 1950. Unless an Olas visa shall be granted to every Jew who has expressed his desire to settle in Israel. Presumably it applies to women too, unless the Minister of Immigration is satisfied that the applicant, one, is engaged in an activity directed against the Jewish people, or two, is likely to endanger public health or the security of the state. So, for example, over the years, they refused to grant citizenship to Robert Soblo, who was an American communist who spied for the Soviet Union. So it was felt that that's not going to be so good for the security of the state. And for a fellow named Victor Vancia, who was a Kahana activist who was convicted of involvement in a series of bombings, and that could potentially endanger public health or the security of the state as well if you're going to start bombing people. Therefore, there were certain exclusions that were made on that basis. Does this have any kind of a halakhic justification. Look at the source 7 as well. The 1954 amendment also included a third exclusion, which most famously was applied in the 1970s to Meyer Lansky, who is a very well-known mobster, who spent a couple of years in Israel in a visitor's visa, but then after a while they decided they have to get rid of him, and he ended up coming back to America, where amazingly he died a natural death. And says, is a person with a criminal past likely to endanger public welfare? So it's not only somebody who's likely to endanger public health because he has Ebola or something like that, somebody who has a criminal past who's going to endanger public welfare. There is, and I pointed out here, that there is a passage in the Talmud Yerushalmi which actually is consistent perhaps with this exclusion. Not that we would ever take away a person's Jewishness if they started out as Jewish, to say that, oh, well, if they have a criminal record, then we're going to divest them of their Judaism. But certainly the notion of not wanting to include them in the community of Israel is supported by this passage. I came across this passage in a tshuva by Rav Asher Weiss in the Minchas Asher, where he talks about, can you reject, this comes up sometimes, can you reject a conversion candidate for side reasons, for sibot tzadiot, namely that the person's prepared to accept all Torah and mitzvot, but they're like really annoying. You know, they're just like, they really rub you the wrong way, and you just don't feel that they're going to fit in well, so can you reject them for those types of extraneous considerations? So Rav Asher Weiss says that you can't really reject somebody because they have personality problems if you think that they're going to fulfill all of the Kol HaTorah Kula, they're going to accept the yoke of commandments and they're going to remain within the fold, unless you think that their personality problems are going to get in the way of their Kabbalah's own mitzvahs. I like the way the Rabbi First Shlita puts it. Rabbi First says, yeah, but if the person has bad character traits, that's also part of Kabbalah's own mitzvahs, right? So here, he does point to a passage in the Yerushalmi, where the Yerushalmi indicates, let's say that you discover that there's some side problem with a person, that you convert them, and then after you converted them, you discovered that this person was a murderer. So there was like some person who the astrologers told him, oh, watch out for the Jews because they're going to spill your blood. So he would constantly kill Jews, like all the time, when he was still not Jewish. Because he was fearful that they're going to spill his blood. But what he didn't realize was that he was eventually going to convert. And when he was going to convert, so they were going to spill his blood by performing a bris milah. But not that he necessarily had to like kill them. So then after he can, and it says he killed like a lot of people, 80 people, 300 people, and so forth. And then the last five words of the passage of Yerushalmi says, Ubisof. And according to the Pnei Moshe, Ubisof means the Achash in his Gayer after he had converted, Noda Lehem Shaharag Yehudim, Kolkach. So then they discovered that he had killed a lot of Jews before he converted. So then, Nispayu Allah Bechazel Siyuro. So then the rabbis davened that he should leave the Jewish community and go back to his previous ways. So that's kind of like an odd thing, but so to wish upon somebody who's Jewish, oh, this person should leave our community and go back to their former religion or to their former lifestyle. But, says the Pnei Moshe, it wasn't that they were rejecting or revoking his conversion. It seems like it was a perfectly fine conversion. He really was Jewish. But they davened that he should go back to his previous ways. And they shouldn't have a murderer living in their midst because this person was mamish a murderer. So we find that there is a basis, even from a halakhic perspective, the idea of banishing somebody from the community, even if they are a valid Jew. This person doesn't say in the Yerushalmi that they revoked his certificate of conversion. He presumably was still halakhically Jewish. But they just the davened that he should leave. He should leave them alone because of the fact that he was a murderer. So you could really justify, even from a halakhic perspective, obviously from a practical perspective, even from a halakhic perspective, this idea that you're not going to give this right to everybody. Now, there was a major controversy that came up in the 1960s, 1963. There was a fellow named Oswald Rufeisen. was somebody who was born Jewish. I think his original name was Shlomo or something.
Brother Daniel, I think.
He became known as Brother Daniel. So this was the Brother Daniel case. There is an entire chapter devoted to Brother Daniel in this book that was written as a collection of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's essays. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein talks about the Brother Daniel case. At the time of the Brother Daniel case, there was not an exclusion from the law of return for somebody who was Jewish, but who converted out of the faith. But this fellow, that's exactly what happened to him. He was born in a town that ended up being Auschwitz. At the time of the Holocaust, when he was still Jewish, he was actually like pretty heroic. He infiltrated a police station in the town known as Mir, in the Mir ghetto in Belarus. And he assumed a fake identity, and by doing so, he pretended to be some German Pole, I don't know. He was able to save hundreds of Jews from execution. He was really like a heroic in a way. But then afterwards, he was hiding out in a convent, and while he was hiding out in a convent, he figured, why keep on hiding in the convent? Why don't I just convert? So he converted to Christianity, unfortunately, and he became eventually a friar. Then he became a full-fledged member of the Christian clergy. And he wanted, in the 1960s, to convert to Judaism because, while religiously he was a practicing Christian, he still identified ethnically as a Jew. He said, what else am I if not a Jew? Ethnically, he considered himself to be fully Jewish. He had a brother who never left the Jewish faith, who was living in Israel, and he just wanted to join his family. He saw there was a lot of anti-Semitism where he was, and he wanted to granted citizenship under the law of return while remaining a practicing Christian. And the Supreme Court in the state of Israel heard the case and deliberated over what to do, and they came to the conclusion that it doesn't work. That you can't have multiple religions. Part of being Jewish is that you are exclusively devoted to the Jewish religion. He just said that I'm Jewish plus I'm Catholic. You know, what's so bad? You know, you could have three gods. My goodness, you know, you could just add another religion, have two religions.
He's Jewish, but
so right,
Catholic.
Yeah. So whatever it was. So that was his argument. And the court struck down that argument. They rejected the government itself rejected his petition. Originally, it was the government that rejected the petition, and then it went to the court, and the Supreme Court of Israel concurred that he should not be granted citizenship. That was one case. And then there was the case of a Benjamin Shalit, who I think had served in the army in Israel, and he left Israel. He married some Spanish woman, and he wanted to come back to Israel and have her granted automatic citizenship. Problem is that there was no pretense of her being Jewish, but he wanted her to be granted citizenship, the children to be granted citizenship. And there was a whole deliberation. But here, in this case, since he never actually left the faith, he just happened to marry somebody who was out of the faith, but why should his family be deprived of citizenship, which was part of who he was? I mean, the simple answer is because he intermarried, but somehow they didn't see it that way, and they felt that his family should be granted citizenship. So you had these two very...
immediate citizenship.
I'm sorry, immediate citizenship. I mean, what happened... his wife, yeah. What happened in the Brother Daniel case... What happened in the Brother Daniel case is that he actually ended up becoming an Israeli citizen, but he went through the normal citizenship process. He went to a monastery, he joined the monastery in Haifa, and very quietly and inconspicuously, he went through whatever was the full-fledged process of becoming a citizen, just like you could be an outsider and come to the United States, not be granted automatic and instant citizenship, but you could be granted citizenship over time if you satisfy all of the requirements. So he did satisfy all the requirements, and he died as an Israeli citizen in Haifa. But the point was, he wasn't granted automatic citizenship. So if you look, nothing happened in terms of the law of return other than these court cases between 1954 and 1970. But 1970, they decided they're going to make an amendment. And they did a couple of things under the amendment. There was one concern that shouldn't the law of return and the definition of Mihu Yehudi be decided on halakhic grounds. That was one concern. And the second concern is, what do we do with a person who converts out of faith? And what do we do with the immediate family members of somebody who's Jewish, who are clearly not Jewish, but maybe we want to grant them citizenship anyway? So they kind of spoke out of both sides of their mouths in terms of what they did in 1970. And they said, on the one hand, we're going to give a little bit of a nod to the rabbis, and we're going to adopt a halacha definition of what is of who is Jewish. But on the other hand, as far as the determining who gets to qualify to be a citizen under the law of return, so we're going to ignore the halakhic definition for certain purposes if we feel that a person went so off the derech, so to speak, that they're not really part of the Jewish community anymore, or in the event that a person is a part of the immediate family of a Jew, even though there's no pretense or argument that the person's Jewish whatsoever, will grant them citizenship. So take a look at source 8.
There's no halachic problem with that, because there's nothing barring anybody from becoming a citizen. You're not saying they're Jewish. You're just saying you're right here as a citizen.
Right, but if the idea of the law of return was that you're going to grant a citizenship to somebody based on being Jew, remember how it started in 1950. The way it started was every Jew has the right to this country, could come to this country as an OLS. So they were changing it. They were changing the terms a little bit, which doesn't mean that they can't do so, but maybe if the whole idea is that this is based on the right, like David Ben-Gurion said, the eternal right of the Jew to the land, so maybe there is something to that, right? So the rights of a Jew under this law and the rights of an Oleh under the nationality, as well as the rights of an Oleh under any other enactment, are also vested in a child and a grandchild of a Jew. This is an incredible thing. It means you have a Jewish man who marries a non-Jewish woman. That non-Jewish woman has children who are clearly not Jewish, so they are also included, and it also says the spouse of a Jew. So now the non-Jewish spouse gets included, and the child gets included, and the grandchild also gets included. Also invested in the child and grandchild of a Jew, the spouse of a Jew, the spouse of a child of a Jew, and the spouse of a grandchild of a Jew. So you can have a giant family of 100 people or so, where the only person who's Jewish is the Jewish grandfather. He's married to a non-Jewish grandmother, and she has all kinds of children and grandchildren and their spouses, and they're all going to be accepted under the law of return.
They weren't saying that they were Jewish.
They were not saying, in fact, exactly. The spouse, except for a person who has been, now, but they did have the carve-out of the brother Daniel situation, except for a person who has been a Jew and has voluntarily changed his religion, his or her religion. So this is an interesting question in and of itself. Does that also have a halakhic basis? So Avraham Lichtenstein wanted to argue that even though the person is considered to be halakhically Jewish, there is some murkiness that is involved with that determination as well. If you look at the pasuk in Yoshua, source Yud Aleph, we know that the spoils of Jericho were not supposed to be taken by anybody, but somebody did take it. That's why they suffered casualties subsequently. And they had to figure out who was it who took it. And Kadosh Baruch Hu said to Yehoshua, Chata Yisrael. Somebody Jewish is guilty over here. And Yeshua wanted to know whom. And Kadosh Baruch Hu said, well, you think I'm a talebearer? I'm an informer? I'm not going to tell you. And then they drew lots. They figured out that it was Achan. But it says, Chata Yisrael. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin derives from the fact that it didn't say Chata Ha'am, that the nation sinned. It said Chata Yisrael, a Jew sinned. So we derive from here that even when a Jew sins, he's still a Jew. Amar Rabbi Abba Bazavda Afa Bishachata Yisrael Hu. Amar Rabbi Abba Haidam Dami Inchi Asa the Kai Beni Chilfi Asa Shmei Asa Karele. If you have a rose amongst thorns, it's still considered to be a rose. You don't lose that fragrance of being a Jew, no matter how far you have strayed, no matter how much you have sinned. So that's one Gemara. On the other hand, the Shulchan Aruch Paskins, this is based on the sugi at the beginning of Maseches Chulin, that sometimes, at least for purposes of certain halachos, you are going to be treated like a non-Jew. Mumma lahakis afilu davar echad. If somebody rebels against the Torah, they rebelliously violate any precept of the Torah as a way of provoking God, or a person decides, like Brother Daniel, that they're going to convert to another religion, or they're going to violate Shabbos openly, or they're not going to keep anything in the Torah, and they're just going to act like a completely secular person, even though they're halakhically Jewish, even if they don't violate Shabbos or Avodah Zarah, but they violate everything else. So then, dino ke'ovi kocharim. Then the person is considered to be like a non-Jew. So we see that sometimes we do have this notion, person's like a non-Jew. Take a look at the Rambam. The Rambam says that there are two mumrim who don't have a place in the world to come. That's the context. Hamuma l'aveira achas, hamuma l'chola torah kula. That a person who even violates one aveira but does it in a way in which they're rebelling against their God, so then they're considered to be a mumar, they're considered almost like an apostate. And then mumar l'chola torah kula, take a look at the Rambam's expression or description of mumar l'chola torah kula. That's the third end of the third line of the Rambam. Mumar l'chola torah kula kigona chozim l'date ovdei kochavim, those who wimp out when it looks like things are going well, when the non-Jews are sort of the winning team, so to speak, v'shashi goes in gzeirah, when they're issuing evil decrees against the Jewish people, v'yidbak v'hem, and he decides, hey, I'm going to be with the winning guys, v'yomer ma'betzeli yidarek v'yisrael, why should I remain Jewish when they're being persecuted, shem shpeilu v'nidofim, tovli she'ebak v'elu she'yadim t'kipa, better for me to be with the side that is now winning and is running the show, ha'reis em mumah l'chol ha'torah kula, that person is a mumah l'chol ha'torah kula. If you have somebody who departs from the faith in such a radical way, the Gemara in Gittin Daf Memheim Beis even says, if I have a Sefer Torah Shekasu Min, that somebody who is a Jew who rebels and they write a Sefer Torah, you know what you do with that Sefer Torah? You burn it, you sar it. As opposed to if the Sefer Torah is written by a non-Jew, it's not even treated as severely. Then it says Yigunis. Then you would just store it away somewhere.
Where were the Hellenists? Were they like,
the Hellenists, I guess it really depends. You know, we say Uvara Pisim Bechilulua, that they were, you know, according to some of the Rishonim, they were responsible for, you know, stamping out, according to the Baal HaMaor, for example, for stamping out the Kedusha in the Beis HaMikdash. So that was pretty bad. Now, if you take a look at the Sifra, the Sifra says that when we have the Pasuk at the beginning of a Yikra, that it says that anybody can bring a korban, it's the most incredible thing. So if you convert to Judaism, so then you, even though you started out as a non-Jew, perfectly fine to bring a korban, but only some of you can bring the hotzias and mishumadim. But a mishumad is not allowed to bring a korban. Somebody who is an apostate. So we have sort of this contrast, which gives us the two flip sides of the law of return, you can argue, between a person who started out not Jewish who converts, that person is a full-fledged Jew, and a person who started out Jewish, but then they decide to become an apostate from the Jewish religion, where they're actually treated more severely than a non-Jew. Because a non-Jew, there's a special Gzeiras HaKasuv that teaches us that a non-Jew actually would be able to bring a korban. But while a non-Jew would be able to bring a korban, somebody who's a mumer, somebody who's an apostate, is not allowed to bring a korban. So the Sifra gives you an explanation for this. He says like this. He says why is it that we draw this distinction? Because the Geirim are Mekabli Bris, they accept the covenant of the Torah. Yatzo Meshubadim She'enim Ameshumadim She'enim Mekabli Bris. The apostates do not accept the covenant of the Torah. Maybe I say you just have to be a descendant. But the Geirim, the converts, do not come from people who are Mekabli Bris. So we say, no, Tam and Lomar, Mikem. That Mikem means that it depends on where you're holding, right now. So it means that what we look at is not where you came from, but what are you doing right now? As opposed to the apostates who are not accepting the Torah right now, because they have repudiated the covenant of God. Now, does that mean, and therefore we say that their korban is considered to be an abomination, does that mean that they're not considered to be Jewish at all? So if you take a look at the Torah, so the Torah has an amazing, amazing shita, really an incredible shita, which does quote from one of the Gaonim that if you had a mumar, somebody who was an apostate from the Jewish religion, who contracted a wedding with a Jewish woman, that it would not be considered to be a valid marriage. It would not even be considered to be a valid marriage. It's the opinion of Rabbi Yudai Gaon. Don't worry, we don't hold that way. But there is such an opinion. The Torah quotes, Yisrael mumar she'kidesh kidusha kidushin, u'sricha b'mena gep, yeshom in the mumar l'chal Shabbos v'fayeshi v'lavad akum, tino ka'akum gomer, is considered to be an absolute non-Jew, v'en kidusha kidushin, below nihira. But the Torah says we don't hold that way. The Beis Yosef, who of course is the Shulchan Aruch, very, very strongly disagrees with this opinion. Look about six lines down in the Beis Yosef, source your test, Simon Kupner and Zion and Ebenezer. Yesh litzmoa misha olo daito heter zeh. That cannot be. Rabbi Yehudai, shenitra b'shmo, I mean, tama, mishum t'gemimi t'moi, any tama, mishum t'gemimi t'mori einayim hava. It must be that this opinion got recorded because the Gaon, in whose name this is quoted, was hard of seeing. He was blind. Sometimes his Talmidim would write down things when he wasn't looking because he couldn't look, and therefore the Talmidim would write down false things in his name, but clearly he could not have said such a thing, because if you're born a Jew, obviously you're always a Jew. So he says that there's no such thing very, very clearly that if you're born from a Jewish mother, you are Jewish, and that's the way that we assume la halacha, that you cannot be shorn of your Jewish birthright just by virtue of being an apostate. But what Rav Aaron Lichtenstein says is that we draw a distinction between being a member of the Knesset Yisrael and having Kedushas Yisrael. So he says as follows. He says that if a person rejects not only Judaism as a religion, but Knesset Yisrael, Jewry as a people, so that's when he says that the person has lost their Kedushas Yisrael. The Kedushas Yisrael is destroyed. So he felt that the decision in the Brother Daniel case was an appropriate decision, because when a person enters into the Jewish people, so there are two different things that they accept upon themselves. One is that they're going to perform mitzvahs. And the other is that we say, oh, you know, Jews are discriminated against, they're persecuted, do you still want to be part of the Jewish religion? And the person says, yes, I'm an Aske, that I'm converting because I want to be part of the persecuted people, that I want to be part of the national identity of the Jewish people. So that's all part of the conversion process. That's why we understand why a convert becomes a full-fledged member of the Jewish people, because he's accepting both of those people. He's accepting both of those distinctions of being part of the religious Jewish community and being part of the national Jewish community. He says the same thing is true with respect to a sinner. If there's identification with Knesset Yisrael, so then the gravest of sinners remains a Jew. So he says like this, as long as there is an identification with Knesset Yisrael, not merely with a political state, the gravest of sinners remains a Jew. As a member of the spiritual community, he retains its quintessential character. It wants a spiritual quality and a legal status, the personal sanctity of the Jew. With the loss of identification, however, there is a loss of identity. Personal status as a Jew, be it for marriage or for any other purpose, is lost. The distinctive mark of Jewry, what being a Jew essentially means, is a face. Kedushas Yisrael is destroyed. Now, he does say that if a person, even if they convert out, he does say that the person does still have the requirements that they have to keep all of the mitzvahs of the Torah. His physical roots in the community are sufficient to make him liable for all obligations and to keep the door open for return. However, he says that the complete alienation from our people and its history, if you identify with another religion, means that for the present, the person, it is legitimate, he thinks halakhically, to view the person as a non-Jew. We wouldn't say that halakhically, that if the person contracted a marriage, that it would not be valid. We don't say it like Rabbi Yehudai Gaon. But Rav Aaron Lichtenstein is saying that there's a sufficient break in the Kedushas Yisrael once the person is no longer identifying with the Jewish nation as a people altogether, that he's joined another religious community, that he thought that the decision in the Brother Daniel case could also be justified halakhically. But you can say that the legislation in 1970 that sort of was an outgrowth of the Binyamin Shalit case, that said that a non-Jewish spouse and the non-Jewish children and the spouses of the non-Jewish children, the non-Jewish grandchildren and the spouses of the non-Jewish grandchildren, that admitting them under the law of return has anything to do with halacha whatsoever. But maybe it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with halacha. We do find, if you look in source Chabes, that at least with the Aseres HaShvatim, if you have an entire category of the Jewish people, they just completely assimilate into the non-Jewish world. There is an opinion based on one of the Lishonos there that the Gemara has in Maseches Yevamos, based on what Shmuel said, that you could take an entire population of people and say that we're going to treat them like full-fledged non-Jews if they really fall off the face of the map in terms of their Jewish identification. You could potentially say that, at least with respect to the Aseres HaShvatim, or those Aseres HaShvatim who moved to different areas where they basically lost their identity altogether. But with respect to somebody that we know to have halakhic roots as a Jew, we're still going to halakhically treat them as Jewish, but it certainly makes sense to say that they've lost a sense of Kedushas Yisrael, and that's why we would, for example, burn their Sefer Torah or not allow them to bring Kabanos and things of that variety. Now, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, whom we know and love, the Rav, wrote a piece. He was interviewed for the newspaper Ma'ariv, and then the publication HaPardes actually published certain parts of that interview. This is from 1978. So 1978, Apardei Shana Nun Beis Choveres Gimel. And what did the Rav have to say about Miu Yehudi? Did he feel that it was merely a political statue and it would have nothing to do with halacha? So the Rav said something very interesting. The Rav said, and these were taken from quotations from the Rav, and the Rav was still active in 1978. If he disagreed with the way that he was being quoted, he could have said something at that point in time. He said, Sarak Atakin Eschok Miu Yehudi. He says, we gotta fix it. We gotta fix it. It's broke. We have a problem with this Miu Yehudi. What's that? Well, Achnisa Samilin, you gotta add three words to Miu Yehudi. What are the three words you gotta add? Api HaLacha. Because he said that when you are dealing with something which is so quintessentially halachic, such as talking about what is considered the definition of being a Jew, even if it's going to be a political legislation which is passed by the Knesset, but it's all about how are we defining the Jew for historical, for nationalistic, for future eternal purposes? He says, you can't really do that without reckoning with the halacha. Mibechina idiogliat, he says, kashia medabim agia shimosad elchati, because, oh, I didn't read, and this is important, the last part of what they changed in 1970. I spoke about it. Where they kind of did give a nod into what the definition of Jew is from the standpoint of halacha, but go to 4b in source 8. For the purposes of this law, a Jew means a person who was born of a Jewish mother. That's good, that works. So we went with the orthodox definition, the halachic definition, not the reformed definition, not patrilineal descent, or has become converted to Judaism and who is not a member of another religion. Now, what does it say in terms of what conversion is going to be acceptable? Does it say it has to be acceptable to the Chicago Rabbinical Council? That's really what the Rav meant. The Rav said it should have added Api Halacha as defined by the Chicago Rabbinical Council. Obviously, that part was implicit. But it left that out in terms of the who is a Jew legislation, left out how you're going to make a halakhic determination. And over the years, the courts in Israel, the Supreme Court has ruled that since there is no clear requirement that it be an Orthodox conversion, as long as it's a conversion under some sort of a recognized denomination of Judaism, an Orthodox, Conservative, or Reform, it's going to be good enough for these purposes. So you'll say, well, it also says in the law of return that a non-Jewish spouse can, you know, be granted citizenship. But the Rav said, to the degree that we are defining the term Jew, it has to be api halacha. Kashem edabim al giyur, shumosad el chati. It's a Jewish, it's a halakhic concept. Sarach ha-hakir is bala mosad ha-halacha. Who's in charge of this organization known as how we define halakhic terms? It's the halacha. Is the inyan shel hasagas gebul. So he says this is considered to be hasagas gebul, whatever that word actually says on the paper. That they should use the munach el kati mibli lezahot et hamakor, that they're going to not actually have the foundation of what is the basis for making these definitions of a Jew. It's you are encroaching upon the domain of the halacha zuachizas einayim. So people said to him, But isn't that creating a big machlokus with the reform and the conservative? He says, I'm not, Gamani Sone machlokus. I don't like machlokus, but I have my principles of a sinister machlokus, ain't for Rusha, Shitzarak, Lebatia, Lali Kronos. I'm not going to sacrifice the principles of faith and my belief system and my ideology in order to just prevent machlokus. There was a letter that was sent by Rav Soloveitchik and by Rav Chaim Heller in 1958. They already were having these problems of how to deal with non-Jewish spouses, of how to deal with non-Orthodox conversions, and David Ben-Gurion at that point in time sent out a letter to Chachmei Yisrael. Chachmei Yisrael is not necessarily the way we would define Chachmei Yisrael. It did include some Orthodox scholars like the Rav, but it also included a lot of non-Orthodox scholars as well. Some people chose not to write back altogether. The Rav wrote back at that point in time with Rav Chaim Heller, and he said, I got to tell you, there are two basic foundations. One is, Vlad Abam in Anachri Sereo Kimosa, you can't confer Jewish status under who is a Jew legislation to somebody who is born to a non-Jewish mother. Alach Shnia Posekis, what the Rav meant to say is that you need to have a valid conversion process. It has to be a geulus kasher b'yeila. It has to be a halakhically valid conversion. But if you're going to consider conferring Jewish rights or Jewish identity upon somebody who doesn't have a halakhically valid conversion, so he says, you're kotzeis netios. You're basically, that's a very strong term the Gemara uses, for people who are uprooting the foundations of our faith, like Elisha ben Abuya was a kotzeis netios. Modernu tmeim lama tabo mishals medinas yisrael v'ti kotzeis netios v'tinasi l'kakeas bivas ayuda sa'atika. You're cutting down the entire foundation of the Jewish people. Shiniskatshe b'damei yisrael shadoes kedun. Then he says, what did all the Jews of all the generations die for? Shirak hodos them. It's thanks to them. Nishma yikudeno kam kadosh me'akusha b'chevli abba aza. Why do you think there was such a great love that you, Ben-Gurion, and your comrades, your colleagues, that you had for Eretz Yisrael? You had that great love because of all of the Jews who were so committed and tied to their faith and the principles of halacha to all the generations that they were prepared to die for the sake of Israel. And therefore, you should stick to your principles. So as I said, what ended up happening is that they did this pshara. And on the one hand, the 1970 law of return says that we only define Jew by in terms of this somebody who has a Jewish mother, but it leaves vague the part about conversion. It says, or you converted. So Rav Soloveitchik said, you left out those three words, api halacha, right? Api halacha, you know, kimibur in Moetzet Rabbanim de Chicago. So you left out those words. So that actually creates a movement right now that some of the Rabbanim, like Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef and others, are saying, now maybe it's a Shasa Kosher, we have a new government, we can make some changes. One of the changes we can make is that when we say that who is a Jew applies to converts, that it means Orthodox converts. Now, they're not getting into the question of, oh, but which Orthodox converts? Okay, fine. So that'll be a separate diyun. But at the very least, that you say Orthodox converts, and Yitzchak Yosef said, this is a country that's based on principles of Orthodox Judaism. The other thing that they really are, that you have a group that's fighting for changing in the law of return right now, is the grandchild clause. Because they say the grandchild clause is ridiculous. It really doesn't have an effect so much in American Olim. Most of the American Olim qualifies who is a Jew without having to rely on the grandfather clause because they're actually Jewish. The non-Jewish children and grandchildren of Jewish people in America are not making aliyah. They're not making aliyah for the most part. But it does affect Eastern Europe. It does affect the former Soviet Union because many, many Olim come from children and grandchildren of somebody who's Jewish. The one who's Jewish doesn't even have to make aliyah. They just have to prove that they had a Jewish grandparent. And you can have families of 500 people or whatever who are moving to Israel, and they have no pretense of wanting to convert to Judaism. You have a separate sort of, right, they have a separate sort of discussion within Israel of, oh, should we maybe relax some of the standards of conversion for those who are the Russian Olim who are not so observant, they don't know so much to be observant, and maybe because they want to be in Eretz Yisrael, so we should be, you know, a little bit more lenient with respect to them. And, you know, maybe there's an argument. Maybe there's an argument. I have here the Tosfos somewhere that's in Yavamos, that's on the bottom of page 4, where the Tosfos says that there the Gemara thought that maybe we only accept converts in Eretz Yisrael. But of course, the Gemara says, no, we accept outside Eretz Yisrael. But why would I have thought that Eretz Yisrael is greater? So he says that maybe, Ba'aretz lo chashinan de mahagribu, that in Eretz Yisrael, I have less of a fear that the converts are going to go back to their previous ways, b'shem de'ika shifcha de Eretz Yisrael. Because you have the beauty of Eretz Yisrael being together with the rest of the Jewish people, or being in the national homeland of Jewish people. Maybe there is more of an argument that once people have made the effort, because of their Jewish identity, to come to Israel, that should be given greater weight. Not that you take it, that you allow somebody to say they're going to be Mechal Shabbos, but you take them, Rav Unterman, of Issa Yehuda Unterman, made that argument. He was a chief rabbi of Israel, and he said that we're not going to compromise on Kabbalah Samitzos, but maybe there's more of an expectation that people can really be expected that eventually they're going to accept Kol HaTorah Kula, even if they're not so perfect at this moment in time, as long as they're not living a non-religious kibbutz. When they say they'll accept the Torah, if they're already in Eretz Yisrael, and they already made this conscious effort to avoid the persecution of the previous, of their previous land, and they didn't identify with the culture or the religion of the land where they came from, the former Soviet Union. So you can make such an argument, but and I leave that to the halakhic authorities in Eretz Yisrael to determine what weight they're going to give to that argument. However, what we're talking about here are multitudes and multitudes of people who have no interest in going to any kind of conversion to Judaism. They're just taking advantage of the law of return as complete non-Jews. So the argument is, okay, we're not even going to argue against the spouse. We're not even going to argue about the cause about the children. But come on, grandchildren and grandchildren's spouses, isn't that, maybe just going a little bit too far? So that right now is really the push in terms of what those who are arguing in favor of a modification to the law of return are arguing for. It's not even such a huge wholesale change from what originally was. It's basically just modifying a little bit what had been introduced in 1970. So those who are opposing it are saying, don't mess with it. We haven't messed with it for 50 years. So you're just going to create hostility, antagonism from the Jewish community, particularly the non-Orthodox Jewish community in America. And why do you want to create that hostility? And without an understanding that it really doesn't affect, that community at all, because it's mostly really directed towards what's going on in terms of those who are coming out from Ukraine, those who came, and you want to take in people who are fleeing a war and persecution, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you grant instant citizenship under the law of return. So one comment that was made, and this is sort of an interesting one, by the head of the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, you take a look in Source 25, William Darrow, says the law of return is a bedrock of Zionism. It certainly is a bedrock of Zionism. It's a bedrock of Zionism, but not necessarily the grandchild clause. The argument is the Nazi argument. What's the Nazi argument? The Nazis said if you have one Jewish grandparent, we're sending you to the gas chambers. Our forebears took the Nuremberg laws and said if one grandparent was enough to kill you, it's enough to let you in. I mean, it's a strong argument from an emotional standpoint, but not really from a halakhic standpoint. Also,
but politically it's okay.
I'm sorry?
I mean, you're letting them in to become a citizen of Israel, but non-Jews can be citizens of Israel also.
Sure, they can eventually become citizens, but the question is, who's given the special status under the law of return, right? That's the real question. Right, and in 1970, when they did change the law, it's just as likely that it wasn't based on the Nuremberg consideration. It may have been based on the you don't want to break up a family consideration, like in the Benjamin Shalit case. But now this is the argument that people are making. I'm just thinking about it, from a halakhic perspective, obviously, it's not a halakhic argument one way or another, since nobody's arguing that these grandchildren are Jewish anyway. It's just a question of what is sort of a necessary step to take in order to maintain the character of Israel. This is what, some of the poskim spoke about. You look at Source Kuftes on page 5, Rav Herzog, spoke about this a little bit. He said one thing that we have to be very, very careful about is that we should not make it appear as if we are engaging in an unfair discrimination against other nations. So, for example, he says, "Vaydei shemenias haplayos v'kipuchem shel muslimim v'notzim gam yachad habe almanat yistodi mitoch hazuchus l'medina shi'itnu lanu." Said, recognize that we only got this Medina right now based on the vote of the United Nations. We're hoping, you know, God willing, we pray Mashiach should come, and it should be something where the whole world sees that it's coming to us from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But he said, you also have to make sure not to provoke people in the wrong way. So even though we might have certain laws that if you're an Ovid or Avodah Zarah, you don't get citizenship. If you're a Ger Toshav, you don't get citizenship. And even if you're a Ger Toshav, who accepts the Zayim Mitzvos B'nei Noach, you don't get citizenship in Yerushalayim. He says we can't practice those laws because, practically speaking, we're not going to be able to hold on to our country if we're going to be discriminatory in that way. So I guess, on some level, we have to think about, from the perspective of having a viable Medina, what are the accommodations that are made to all of those who identify as Jewish as well. You know, but Moshe Feinstein has a very interesting comment when he speaks about the Falashas, that's how he calls them, the Ethiopian community in Source Laman Aleph, where he says that it's a suffix, in his opinion, whether they're Jewish or not. But he says, look at the second line of the first line of the second paragraph on page 5, Laman Aleph, Mimgam Kodem Gerusim, but even before they convert. This is very interesting. Yesh mitzvah v'hasila mishmana misakana, we still have to take care of them, kedin ko yisrael, as if they were Jewish. Shesafik nefashas ta'akel, okay? Number one, because maybe they're Jewish. And then he adds, v'gam yesh ladas she'afidu im ledina enam yehudim mikomoko me'acha shechoshim she'em yehudim, since they think that they're Jewish, v'mosim nashim al yadusam, and they're willing to sacrifice their lives for their Jewishness, we have to save them. So part of what we have to think about is what are the reasonable accommodations that we make to our laws to address those people who really do identify as Jewish, want to identify with the Jewish people, and are willing to give of themselves to join the army and to really put their lives on the line for the Jewish people. That doesn't necessarily play out in every single manifestation of these cases that we are discussing right now, but it is, you know, something that has to be probably part of the calculus as well. But we also have to recognize that halacha, when we are speaking about actual halacha, that can only be determined by the halakhic authorities. You can't have the Knesset deciding the halakha. That's why I included in the materials the source of the Maharsha.
But then you have the high courts deciding halakha, right?
You can't have the high courts deciding halakha. That's the Maharsha in Source Lamed, where he speaks about how the Mizbeach was gerrymandered so that a portion of it was, most of it was in the portion of Binyamin, which represented the spiritual component of the people, and only a tiny bit, a tiny corner, was in the section of Yehuda, which was the monarchy of the people, and that section didn't have a base to it, so that it shouldn't take up any of the Mizbeach. And he said that in the southeastern side, and he said that the reason for that is that you cannot have any kind of an intersection between the portion of the Keser Kahuna with the Keser Malchus, because you need to have a separation. Kimen Shem Mizbeach Shu Keser Kahuna in a royal Yos Mako Malchus, because otherwise you can have an improper influence from the Malchus on the Kahuna. So it's the same thing here as well, that you shouldn't have an influence from the government on how we're going to define halacha, because that is going to compromise and cheapen our Mesorah in terms of the sanctity of the halacha that we've had and practiced throughout all of the ages. So here's where I would say that it's important that to the degree that the legislation is speaking about Jewish identity and Jewish definition, that should very much be in loyalty to the halacha. To the degree that we decide that it has nothing to do with halacha and we're acknowledging that the people are not Jewish, so that's a political consideration that, you know, depends upon what are just sort of the practical accommodations that we have to make in appreciation for those who are really sacrificing and giving themselves for the country. But I'll just conclude with the source Lamed Beis over here, from Rav Sadja going in the Amunas Videos, is the Ein Emunah Seinu Uma Ela B'Torah Seil. Then ultimately, what's going to enable us to continue succeed within Eretz Yisrael is to have policies that always and laws that force them in further respect for the halakhic process and for Torah principles. And this will be the best way, I believe, of ensuring that the current state of Israel brings us closer, and yes, Hashem, to the Gula Shlem.
Amen. Questions wait till after Mariam. Or call in order to call.
Very much.